The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we're taking a look at some of the ways that our brains have evolved to fail when trying to cope with reality. Guest host Rochelle Saunders will discuss cognitive dissonance with Carol Tavris, co-author of the book Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me. But first, we'll get a primer on probability and why human beings are instinctively so very bad at it. Thanks for listening. I'm here with Dr. Jeffrey S. Rosenthal. Jeffrey is an award-winning researcher and a professor in the Department of Statistics at the University of Toronto. He holds a PhD in mathematics from Harvard University, and he's also the author of Struck by Lightning, The Curious World of Probabilities. Welcome to the show, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
Now, we wanted to have you on the show to talk about why our brains are so bad at probability, but before we get into that, I thought it would be good to get some background on what we're actually talking about. So for me and my fellow math phobes, could you explain what probability is?
Probability, I guess, is the study of randomness and uncertainty. So whenever we're not sure what's going to happen next, whether it's we're flipping a coin or we're rolling a die or we're waiting for the lottery or we don't know if someone's going to shoot us to death tonight or if the bus will be late or anything else, we're not sure what will happen, but we can still use mathematics to analyze the possibilities with the relative probabilities. So if you're taking a flight tonight, there's some chance it's going to crash and you're going to die, but that's actually a very small chance, and probably it's going to be fine. So we can analyze those different probabilities.
So probability is about predictiveness then?
Yeah, to some extent, about studying the randomness and for purposes it could be of trying to predict or of trying to estimate what the probabilities are or trying to understand how the probabilities will propagate with time. But yeah, you could think of it as trying to, let's say, estimate or at least understand the unknown.
So where does probability theory as a mathematical discipline come from?
Well, historically, if people first started talking seriously about the mathematics of probability when they were studying gambling games, actually, and wanted to know which games would make the money in the long run and which ones wouldn't. But now there is quite a well-developed theory of the mathematics of probabilities and all sorts of ways that probabilities combine together and can be used, can be understood, can be calculated, can be estimated, and so on. So there's actually lots of people working on the mathematics of probability.
So basically it evolved from guys counting cards into a branch of mathematics?
It wasn't so much counting cards. That's more of like a blackjack technique, but more estimating the probabilities of things. So there were these very simple gambling games involving things like rolling dice and so on, and in about, I guess, the 17th century, there were some gamblers, and they had a certain game that on average was making them a lot of money, and they were happy, and then they switched the game a little bit, but they thought it would still work the same way, and all of a sudden they weren't making money, and they said, hey, why is this happening the way it is? Why have the probabilities changed? And that's when people first started working out the mathematics of probability.
And so it's now pretty much the core of modern physics, isn't it?
Well, I'd like to call it the core because I work in probability. I think physicists probably would say it's not the core, but it's one of the important things. And certainly in physics, the theory of quantum mechanics says that no matter how accurately we measure and no matter how much we know, we can't say exactly what's going to happen next. We can just say what are the probabilities of what's going to happen next, at least on a microscopic level. So, yeah, in a certain sense, probability is really right at the foundation of our current understanding of the way the universe works.
And it also plays a big part in studying genetics, I understand.
Yeah. So, I mean, genetics, the simplest way to think about it is, you know, if a man and a woman have the baby gets half the genes from the mom and half the genes from the dad, and it's just random luck which genes come from which parent. So if you think of it that way, then the way things propagate, whether they're diseases or genetic traits and so on, can all be thought of in terms of randomness and probability.
Now, probability theory is famous for proposing a lot of thought experiments, so I do want to mention a couple. You wrote a paper in 2008 called A Mathematical Analysis of the Sleeping Beauty Problem. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so that was one of these things that actually came. I was actually visiting Australia and saw some old friends who are now philosophy professors and went out to dinner with a group of philosophy professors, and they said, say, what's your opinion on the Sleeping Beauty Problem? And I said, what are you talking about? And they explain it. It's sort of one of these problems that's extremely simple, and then you think about it and you start getting a little puzzled. Of course, there's a lot of probability problems which are a bit that way. So in this one, the idea is there's this fictional character, Sleeping Beauty, and you put her to sleep. I guess you give her a drug so she goes to sleep, and then you flip a coin, and if the coin comes up heads, then you wake her up on Monday and ask her if she thinks the coin was heads or tails, and then you put her back to sleep so she has amnesia and forgets the whole thing, and then you wake her up again on Tuesday and say, hey, do you think the coin was heads or tails, and ask her her opinion. Whereas if the coin came up tails, then you only wake her up once, only on the Monday. So in other words, you wake her up either twice or once, depending on whether the coin is heads or tails. And then the question is, well, what should she say is the probability that that coin was heads or tails? Should she say it's equal to a half because it was 50-50 in the first place? Or is it equal to two-thirds because you're going to wake her up twice as often when it's heads as tails? Or is it equal to three-quarters or some other amount? And it turns out there's a big debate in philosophy about this, and it's one of those things that's a little hard to put your finger on. So it's just an example of how very simple probability things can actually be stumpers, or at least can get people thinking and talking.
This is what philosophers do in their spare time.
Well, not in their spare time. I mean, papers are written about these things because it gets that it's interesting because most of the probability we do is really more from the mathematical point of view or sometimes from the sort of applied or statistical point of view. But there's a whole philosophical perspective, which for the most part is not what I do, but it's about, you know, how do we really put our finger on what does it mean to say what the probability is? And even in such a simple experiment, there's different ways of thinking about it and which one's the right way to think about it.
Now, maybe the most famous problem that everybody talks about in probability is something called the Monty Hall problem.
Yeah, so that's another one, which is a sort of simple-seeming little puzzle, and it seems like it shouldn't be a big deal, but it's led to a huge amount of controversy. So in that one, it comes from its sort of modeled on that old show, Let's Make a Deal, which had the host Monty Hall, and it says, well, suppose there's three doors, and you're told there's a car behind one of those three doors, but you don't know which one. And then you guess because you're trying to win the car. So you guess, let's say, it's door number one, which has the car. But then Monty Hall, he doesn't tell you if you're right or not. What he does is he opens up some other door, like maybe door two, and says, hey, look, there's no car behind door number two. Now would you rather stick with your original guess that the car is behind door number one or switch to the other door, which in this case is door three? So say, no, now I really think it's behind door three. And most people might think, well, you know, maybe it's 50-50. It doesn't really matter if you stick with your original door one or switch to door three. But it turns out if you assume that Monty Hall was always going to open up some other door which did not have a car behind it, in that case, it's actually smarter to switch to that third door three. And that way you'll have a two-thirds chance of winning as opposed to just a one-third chance if you stick with your original door. So it's a bit of a probability puzzle. But when it was first proposed around 1990 or so, it led to a huge controversy and thousands of people writing in angry letters and saying it was wrong and so on. And then I, in my book, I mentioned a little bit about it. And I got a few angry emails, a few, but people still say, no, it's wrong. That's not how it works. And I ended up writing another paper about it. And now there's a big debate happening on Wikipedia now, which I haven't gotten involved in, but people email me about it. And people get very passionate about it. And they think, you know, it's wrong. It must be 50-50. Or no, you're right. It's equal to a two-thirds chance if you switch. But what I find most amazing is how passionate people get, which in a way is good because it means people care about these things.
Well, is the reason why people get so angry just because it doesn't match up with their intuitive sense?
That's right. I think people think they see how it should work, and then somebody says, no, actually it works differently. And people think, no, you're wrong. And yeah, people get emotional because they think it's obviously right their way, and somebody else is saying it's a different way. So the other person must be wrong and must be stupid and so on. So it does lead to some very strong feelings.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. We're talking with Dr. Jeffrey Rosenthal about probability theory, and we'll be right back after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. And now back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm here with Dr. Jeffrey Rosenthal, professor in the Department of Statistics at the University of Toronto and author of Struck by Lightning, The Curious World of Probabilities. Can you give us some examples of the ways that we mess up when we're trying to figure out the odds of something happening? Because it seems to happen often.
It does. I mean, it's interesting. People will have their intuitions about probabilities, and they won't necessarily even think of it in terms of probabilities, but they'll say, oh, I think this is unlikely, and this is likely, and so on. And to some extent, I think people get it right. You know, there's some chance that little green men are going to come from Mars tomorrow and shoot us all with a ray gun, but most people realize it's not very likely. It's not a very high probability, and so on. But there are certainly cases where people's intuition does fail them, and certainly one thing is people will overestimate certain very rare things because, let's say, they come up in the news and so on. So, for example, if people take an airplane flight, a lot of people will think the chance that they're going to get into an accident is a lot higher than it really is. If people buy a lottery ticket, they think the chance they're going to win the jackpot is higher than it really is. If people hear about, you know, crimes in the news, they think the crime rate is higher than it is, and there's a higher chance that they're going to get shot to death by a stranger tonight than there really is. So that's one thing people tend to mess up, is they tend to overestimate things which are actually really unlikely just because they sometimes get into the news.
Well, so why is that?
Well, so, of course, it's hard to say exactly why, but I do have a sort of theory, which is that I figure we evolved in a time when we didn't get so much news about so many people. So if we were, you know, traveling in the forest with, let's say, a group of 50 prehistoric humans, and you hear that somebody's been killed, well, that's bad, because that means one of the 50 people right around you has been killed by, let's say, a lion. There's probably a lion around, and you might be next, and you better run and hide, and you better take protective actions. Whereas nowadays, if we see a newspaper headline that says somebody's been killed, that's one person out of maybe, you know, the 34 million people in Canada, or
right,
the 100 million people in North America. And for whatever reason, this has become a front page story. It doesn't mean there's a lion right around the corner. It means that out of the millions and millions of people, someone's been killed. But we still feel it in a more immediate way because of the magic of modern media. And we feel like it's someone right around the corner, and we feel like we could be next.
We also have a problem really seeing causation.
Well, absolutely. I mean, even for scientists, it can be very subtle causation because, you know, there's a saying in statistics that correlation does not imply causation. And it means even if things tend to go together for whatever reason, that doesn't necessarily mean that one caused the other. There's sort of silly examples where you say, oh, look, the price of eggs has gone up. And also, you know, the fee that I'm getting paid for my consulting work went up. So must be that people are paying me because they're making profit off of the egg industry. And of course, say, no, it's not that. It's just because they're both caused by inflation, or they're both caused by a general increase of prices. So that's kind of a silly example, but it comes up in ways which are more subtle. So one is, for example, there was a study that said people who watched more television when they were young were also more likely to get involved in violent crime when they were older. And they said, aha, this proves it's because people watch TV and there's all that violence on TV, and that desensitizes them and that convinces them to become violent. And that's one possible interpretation of the fact that those two things go together. But when you start to think about it, you realize there's other possible interpretations too. And for example, one is, well, maybe people who watch a lot of TV when they're younger, it's because they're in a family situation where there are not a lot of other opportunities for other things to do.
Right.
Maybe they don't get to go to summer camp, and they don't get to have piano lessons, and they don't get whatever. So maybe they come from a family that, for whatever reason, is not as well off, is not as wealthy, doesn't give them as many interesting opportunities. And that upbringing might make it more likely that they're going to get involved in crime. So if you think of it that way, it might not be the fault of the television per se. So it can be very hard to untangle what causes what.
And those two specifically are very problematic because, you know, policies and platforms and such are built on those ideas and those opinions.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot of things where people make policies based on misinterpretation. So whether it's, yeah, misinterpreting the causation of, you know, the effect of TV on children. Also things we mentioned briefly, the crime rate, and certainly people will tend to have a highly exaggerated sense of how dangerous it is out there, how high the crime rate is, and seems like no matter how many statistics are presented that say that, you know, the murder rate's actually been gradually decreasing in recent years, they'll still believe it's increasing, and no matter how many statistics show how unlikely it is that you're going to be murdered, they'll still think it's pretty likely, and that certainly affects policies. You know, certainly a lot of politicians can make a lot of advances with the electorate by, you know, promising tough on crime and more prisons and tougher sentences and this and that, and things that, of course, you know, may or may not be a good idea, but are not justified by the crime data, but somehow people think that they are.
So really, this is problematic. A number of our cognitive biases are rooted in our problems with understanding real probabilities, it seems.
Yeah, well, I certainly would think of it that way. I mean, I work in probability, I think probability is a good way to understand all kinds of things in the world around us whenever we're not sure what's going to happen next. So I think the better we understand the way probabilities work, the better we'll be able to deal with those things. And yeah, often people don't. I mean, part of it's just whether people think rationally versus just base things on their fears or their hopes or dreams. And then part of it is, even if people think they're behaving rationally, well, they might not really understand the way the probabilities work.
Well, there's the clustering illusion. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so that's an interesting thing. So one way I like to think about it, which is the way I discuss it in the book, I have sort of a diagram, and it says, suppose you're throwing darts at a wall at random, and you're marking a little X for every place where the dart hits, and you do this for a long, long time, and then you stop and you look at the wall, and you say, what kind of pattern will these X's make? Well, you might think the X's will just be equally spread out on the wall, because after all, each dart was equally likely to go anywhere and had no influence on any other dart. But if you actually do the experiment, or if you study the mathematics of it, you'll see that those X's will tend to clump up in various ways, that there'll be certain small regions where there's a whole bunch of X's that just happen to all land there, and there might be certain whole other regions where there's hardly any X's at all, and there might be some other patterns, like maybe a bunch of X's look like they're almost in a row and so on. And if you look at just the X's, you'll think there's some special pattern and some special causation here, and maybe the guy was really aiming at this part of the board, or maybe he was trying to make this pattern, or maybe there's some special force involved. But actually, what the theory of Poisson clumping or Poisson distribution or Poisson processes tells us is that even if it's all happening just randomly, you'll still tend to see these clumping and see these patterns. And the significance of that is that there's often times in life when we see some sort of clumping. Like, for example, maybe you get, let's say, five different wrong numbers on your phone on the same evening. And you think, this is crazy. You know, I didn't get any wrong numbers last week. Why would I get all these wrong numbers on the same evening? Well, it could be that there's some force of all. You know, maybe your phone number has just been published in the newspaper or something. But it could also be that it just tends to happen by clumping. So if you look at all the wrong numbers you're going to get over the course of a year, they won't be nicely spaced out one every 2 weeks or whatever. They'll tend just by chance to clump up to some extent. And people don't really realize that, so they're likely to see patterns when there aren't really any patterns.
That is fascinating, honestly.
I think so.
Well, how about positive outcome bias? This one is extremely problematic, in my opinion.
That's something which can come up not only in everyday life, but in sciences too, for that matter. You know, if you're doing measurements, in, whether it's in a lab or, you know, you're trying to figure out what's going on, and you really hope, gee, I really hope that, you know, there's the effect that, let's say, that this drug is going to make me feel better, or that, you know, if I smile at people, they're going to be nice to me, or whatever thing you think you believe, you'll tend to notice more the times when it's confirmed. That is, look, I smiled at them and they like me, so it must prove my theory. Or you'll tend to, you know, judge saying, well, you know, this time let's just say he was nice to me, he was a little bit nice to me, and we'll call it that way. So people will certainly tend to notice things which confirm the theories that they already believe. And so we can call that sort of an observational bias. That is, if you tend to only notice the things which support your theory, or if something's a bit ambiguous, you sort of interpret it as supporting your theory. In that case, you could convince yourself that there's evidence for your theory when, in fact, maybe there isn't. You're just not being objective.
There are so many things wrong with that.
Well, it's true. I mean, certainly, I mean, I think I say something in the book about that's one of the ways when people have political discussions, let's say, or political debates, hardly ever does either side convince the other side. And I think, well, the reason why is each side kind of thinks of and quotes the evidence which supports their own point of view. So I say, well, you know, look at this country, that proves that we shouldn't do that. And they say, yeah, but look at this other country, whatever. And if we're all just noticing the examples and the evidence which supports our own theory, then, you know, we're going to keep presenting this evidence to each other, but we're not going to convince each other because we're each focused on our own evidence or our own interpretation.
That's depressing. So is there any way for the average person to get better at grasping probabilities without getting a PhD in mathematics?
Well, I certainly think there is. And in fact, the whole point of my book really was a book that's, you know, just for the general public. And it's a way to think about some of these things in a simple, logical way that, you know, without any equations or any higher math or anything complicated, just to explain simple situations and give examples and see the way things work. And I do think that if people think about those kind of things, it provides more intuition. I mean, I've certainly had people say, you know, hey, you know, I had, let's say, you know, today I saw three different people, all of whom had their hair dyed purple, But hey, because I read your book, I knew that was just an example of Poisson clumping, and it doesn't mean it's a new trend. Or you know, someone told me I was thinking of traveling to the Middle East, but then we were going to cancel because of the terrorist activities. But, you know, we read your book, and now we see that the probability that we'll be a victim of a terrorist activity is still extremely small, and things like that. So sometimes it's just a question of, you know, taking the time to think a little bit about the logic of the situation.
Thanks very much for being here, Jeffrey.
Okay.
You can find out more about Dr. Jeffrey Rosenthal and his book, Struck by Lightning, The Curious World of Probabilities, at his website at probability.ca. And for more info on a specific branch of probability, check out our interview in episode 41 with Aaron Santos. His book, How Many Licks, is a wonderful and amusing look at Fermi estimation. It's available on the episode's page of our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. Right now, stay tuned for more about the ways that our brains betray us, as guest host Rochelle Saunders talks to author Carol Tavris about cognitive dissonance right after this.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Hello, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your guest host, Rochelle Saunders, filling in for regular host Desiree Schell, who will be back next week. My guest today is Dr. Carol Tavris, a fellow of the American Psychological Association and charter fellow of the Association for Psychological Sciences, and the co-author of the best-selling book, Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me, Why We Justify Foolish Beliefs, Bad Decisions, and Hurtful Acts. Welcome to the show, Carol.
Delighted to be with you.
And we're delighted to have you. So first things first, what exactly is cognitive dissonance?
I thought you would never ask. Cognitive dissonance is one of those terms that you hear all the time and you think you know, so let me explain it this way. It's really, in its essence, very simple. It is the discomfort we feel, the dissonance, the discomfort, when we hold two ideas that are mutually contradictory or that clash or conflict with each other in some way. The dissonance might also be between an attitude we hold and a behavior that we're doing that is inconsistent with the attitude. So Lewis Black defined it on the Jon Stewart show by saying cognitive dissonance is when an environmentalist, the kind of person who recycles plastic, buys an SUV. Might as well be filling the gas tank with cognitive dissonance, is what he said. That's a wonderful example of the kind of situations we might all find ourselves in. The classic definition is the smoker. If you are a smoker and you know that smoking is harmful, you are living in a state of cognitive dissonance. And the original theory by Leon Festinger more than 50 years ago said the point to understand is dissonance is uncomfortable. It's as motivating to resolve for us as being hungry or thirsty. So a smoker, to resolve dissonance, has to do one of two things: quit smoking or justify smoking, minimize the dangers of smoking. It's not so bad. My Aunt Elizabeth lived to be 103 and she smoked every day. Or I would rather die younger but thinner, whatever the rationale might be. So dissonance is the discomfort we feel, but when we hold two attitudes, two beliefs that are uncomfortable, that clash with each other. Sometimes these attitudes, it's sort of trivial. For example, if your best friend loves Woody Allen movies and you hate Woody Allen movies, you'll feel a bit of dissonance about it, but it's something you can easily live with. What my co-author and colleague Elliot Aronson did, he's one of the greatest social psychologists in our business, was he moved the theory of cognitive dissonance into a theory of self-justification, because what he showed was that dissonance is most uncomfortable. We are most motivated to reduce it when we get discrepant information that questions our self-concept, something about ourself that's important, our skepticism, our ability to be open-minded, how smart we are, how competent we are, how ethical or kind and compassionate we are. when we're confronted with evidence that we did something wrong, that we made a bad decision, that we weren't so competent, that we did some foolish error, to reduce that dissonance, we have to either admit it and say, boy, did I screw up, or dismiss the evidence of our own incompetence or the harm that we caused. Tragically, what most people choose to do is dismiss the evidence so they can continue to see themselves as being good, kind, compassionate, and so forth. It's why it's so important to understand how dissonance works in our own lives, because it's an interesting psychological mechanism. When we understand how it works, we can take steps to control for the impulse to reduce it in self-defeating directions. That's a long answer to a very simple question, I know.
These questions are never as simple as they seem to be.
No.
So I've heard that dissonance theory, which is, of course, a theory of cognitive dissonance, goes against some of our common sense expectations of how people behave or think in certain situations. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, the predictions that came from dissonance theory are not at all obvious. And certainly in the skeptical and scientific world, let's take, for example, when prophecy fails. People make a prediction that the world is going to end, and to date, it has not. Now, we look at people like that, like Harold Camping or, you know, any of the many other people who have made doomsday predictions, and we say, well, as soon as they see that the world hasn't ended, they'll give up their religious belief. They'll give up their notion that they were able to read the directions in the Bible accurately, won't they? Because it's so clear that they're wrong. But what dissonance theory would predict is, given a belief that is central to you, crucially important to you, say a religious belief, when such a person is confronted with disconfirming, dissonant information, they are more likely to dismiss the information than change the belief. So what you would predict from dissonance theory is that someone like Harold Camping and his followers would come out of a failed prediction feeling even more strongly committed to the original religious belief. They would say something like, thanks to the belief of our little band, God has spared the world yet again. They would find a religious explanation for the failed prediction. This is how dissonance theory leads us to understand why, for me, the funniest example is why everybody can see a hypocrite in action except the hypocrite, right? I mean, we can look at Newt Gingrich, who was perfectly happy to impeach Bill Clinton for having an affair in the White House while he himself was conducting himself in exactly the same way. How is it that people are able to do this? And the answer is they reduce the dissonance between I'm a person who believes in fidelity in marriage, but look, I seem to be having an affair here. They have to find a way to reduce that dissonance that allows them to continue to think well of themselves. That's what dissonance does. It protects us from any attack on our self-concept. Now, in our book, what we try to show repeatedly is why this is so potentially harmful in our society and in our relationships. The problems we face come not from bad people or evil people who justify the bad and evil things they do. They come from good people who justify the bad things they do in order to preserve their belief that they're good people.
Right.
A doctor who makes a mistake and can't believe, I'm a doctor. I'm a compassionate, good doctor. I don't make mistakes. Therefore, you know, I don't have to listen to this evidence that I made a mistake. A district attorney who put an innocent person in prison for 37 years and is confronted with DNA evidence that he put the wrong guy away says, well, you know, okay, he didn't commit that crime, but he committed some other crime. He's a bad person. We see over and over in our culture that once people make a decision and believe they are right in that decision, they will then only see and notice and remember the evidence that confirms the rightness of that decision and ignore and dismiss and forget information that is dissonant with their belief or their decision. That's a natural part of how the brain works, but you can see how it can lead us astray.
Absolutely. So this is really confirmation bias at work.
Yes. The original predictions of dissonance theory have remained and have been replicated since the very beginning. But what we've learned in the interim from literally thousands of experiments in cognitive science is what the cognitive mechanisms are underlying dissonance theory. So, for example, human beings have three characteristic built-in cognitive biases. One is the bias that we have no bias. I love this one. It's my personal favorite. I see things clearly as they really are. You are biased. Therefore, if I can just get you to sit down here with me so that I can tell you why you're wrong, you will understand why you're wrong, and you will thank me very much for my information. And if you don't agree with me, it's because you're the one who's wrong. You have the bias. We all feel we are seeing things the right way, and it's hard to accept that other people think so too. The second bias is, as you point out, the confirmation bias. I think this is the most central thing to understand, because the mind really is designed for us to keep our beliefs consonant, consistent. That's why we notice and remember information that confirms what we believe, and we really pay much less attention to any information that's discrepant. It's why science is so important. Science is one of the few methods we have that forces us to consider disconfirmation of our beliefs, that forces us to hold our beliefs up to the test and to see if we will be disconfirmed. The mind doesn't like that, you know. It's not an easy thing to accept. And then the third bias, as I mentioned before, is the bias to think that we are somehow better than average. It's the Lake Wobegon bias. We're better than average, kinder than average, you know, more confident than average, cuter than average. And as a result of these three biases, it is very difficult for us to accept information that attacks these very central views of ourselves. It's why people get so upset when you tell them that a memory they have of something in their past is wrong. You know, it's the famous thing in families between siblings and parents and children. You remember it that way, you're completely wrong. I'm completely wrong? What are you saying? It's a very scary feeling. But we know from memory research that our memories are shaped to be consonant with our current views of ourselves and of the stories we tell to explain ourselves.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking with guest host Rochelle Saunders, standing in for Desiree Schell. So there's a lot of evidence to suggest that our memories aren't as reliable as we often think they are, which you were talking about before. Mm-hmm. Witnesses don't accurately remember the events of a crime, or we embellish a story to make ourselves seem cooler. How does cognitive dissonance and self-justification affect how and what we remember?
How and what we remember affects cognitive dissonance, perhaps we should put it that way.
Ah.
Works like this. Many people think, incorrectly as you say, that memory works like a recorder. It clicks on at the moment of birth and everything that happens to you is somehow in there. And we now understand that memory is a constantly constructed process. So, for example, if you have a wonderful relationship with your mother now, you feel really good about her, you have a good time, you think she's a terrific person and you love how she raised you, your memories from childhood are going to emphasize those experiences you had with your mother that were positive and warm and good. And if your relationship with your mother now is conflicted and tense and angry, then you're going to remember more of the negative incidences from your childhood.
Right.
What's so interesting is when researchers have actually followed adolescents over time, and they'll do a study where they'll have them come into the laboratory and have an argument with their parents separately, their mother and their father separately, and then they come back some months later and say, "What do you remember about that quarrel?" The kids who have a good, strong relationship with the parent minimize how upset they were at the time by the conflict and the quarrel that they had. They minimize it. It wasn't important. And the kids who have a conflicted relationship with their mother or their father remember the conflict, the quarrel, as being far worse than they actually reported it as at the time. So we shape the memory of what happened in that fight into a general belief about how we are with our parents now. In that way, we keep our memories consonant with our current beliefs about our parents. That's the really, really interesting thing about, when I said at the beginning, we don't like being in a state of dissonance. We just, it's really an uncomfortable state, and so the mind wants to resolve it. So one thing, for example, we do is, you'll notice this when you ask people to tell you about their childhoods or how their parents treated them. They say things like, my stepfather was really a mean son of a bitch, and he was hard on me, and he disciplined me, he was such a strong disciplinarian, and I never got to go out, that kind of story. They don't say, they don't ever think, maybe I was the kind of kid who was rebellious and difficult and caused him to be stern and authoritarian with me. So, you know, we write our own part of the story out of the memory. He was bad. He did these bad things to me. That's my story. That's what I remember, and I'm sticking to it. And so if you were now to try to say to that person, you know, but look at these examples where your stepfather did all these things for you and you told him to get lost, the person won't remember those experiences because they are dissonant with his view of his stepfather.
So we really construct memories to bolster our current opinions or beliefs, and as those current opinion beliefs change, do we actually reconstruct those memories?
Absolutely. This is such an interesting thing. I was reading a study recently, but I mean, you can see this in your own life and in anybody else's life. Very often what happens is people will suddenly come upon something from their parents, you know, maybe these letters their parents wrote to a friend or that they wrote about their children and so forth. And one woman I interviewed found her diary that she had been keeping all through her adolescence, and she said, I have no idea who that person was. I was angry at my mother all the time. We were fighting all the time. I don't know why my mother kept me in the house. I don't know why she just didn't put me outside on the doorstep. We were fighting. I was mad at her. Nothing she did was right. She said, I can't remember that girl now. My mother and I have a great relationship. I love her. She's terrific. I have no idea who I was when I was 14, 15, and 16. That's what's so incredibly interesting. And it means we need to be a little more open-minded and humble and maybe amused by this great power of the mind and of memory to change, to be consonant with how we see things now. Because we will learn more about ourselves, our relationships, and our past if we're able to entertain some dissonant information. There's a great story in our book from one of the very famous cognitive psychologists. His field is the study of autobiographical memory. And he remembered when he graduated from college that he accepted an offer to go to graduate school at Stanford, and he wanted to get away from Michigan and his mother, and he wanted to go west and start a new life and start a new career and get away from home and get away from his mother and, you know, be an independent person and strike out, okay? And years later, he went home for his mother's 80th birthday, and she gave him a box of letters. And there in the letters that he pulled out was the ample, clear, unmistakable evidence that it was he who wanted to stay at home in Michigan and she who practically forced him to accept the offer of Stanford.
Wow.
He said, I changed my memory completely because my memory, I wanted to believe that I was independent and would leave home and didn't want to be next to mom, you know, and I was completely wrong. So we all do it, even memory scientists.
Everybody does it. We just keep coming up with this stuff to justify who we are now.
So this is true.
In your book, you talk about the era of repressed and recovered memories in clinical psychology in the 80s and 90s. And today the idea of repressed memories still pops up all the time on TV shows and in all kinds of other fiction. What part did cognitive bias of mental health professionals play in the promotion of this theory?
How many hours do I have? let me give you a metaphor that we use in our book that I think is a very useful metaphor. Imagine a pyramid, a big triangle. You got two people at the very top, side by side. They have the same attitude toward anything, any issue. Okay? Now they have to make a choice. They have to make a choice about something. Should I cheat or should I not cheat? Should I believe in this new fad that's coming down the pike called recovered memory therapy? Or should I wait and see if there's any data for it? Should I believe that Dominic Strauss-Kahn is guilty, or should I wait and see if there's any evidence that comes along? I don't have to tell you, with celebrity cases, we all make a decision. Yeah? Now, what happens the minute we make any decision from the top of that pyramid to buy one car over another car, to blow the whistle or not blow the whistle, to take up a new fad or not take up a new fad. The minute you make a decision of any kind, we experience what's called post-decision dissonance. Before we make a decision, before we take a position on an issue, we're open-minded. We try to gather evidence, pro and con for both sides. The minute we make a decision, it's as if our mental doors close on the decision we did not make. And so now, having made a choice, made a decision, we will now look for because of confirmation bias, all the evidence to confirm that we made the right decision. And we will ignore evidence that we made the wrong decision, and we will ignore evidence that the other decision might have been the better one or the smarter one. Dominic Strauss-Kahn is actually a good example, or, you know, Michael Jackson, or anybody celebrity in the news, the lacrosse team at Duke. You know, we all think we know what happened, and we take a position, and we'll change our minds or not as evidence comes along. But the minute we make a decision, we will justify that decision as having been the right and the wise one. And then as a result of that, we will continue justifying that decision more and more, because now if I've made the decision that I'm going to believe this new fad, to take it back means to admit to myself that I was wrong. Well, rather than do that, I will continue justifying what I did. Now, what we try to show in the book is how this pyramid works over time and in many different situations. In the case of recovered memory, this is a very good example of how this can happen at the level of a social movement. There was a case of Eileen Franklin, a woman who claimed that she'd had a recovered memory of her father murdering her best friend when she was 8 years old, that this memory was recovered in therapy, was accurate, and so forth, and her father was arrested and convicted at first. Now, until that case, there was no evidence that there was such a mechanism that somebody could experience a truly traumatic event and repress the memory for years and years and years and then have it pop out in a pristine fashion years later in therapy. In the 90s, in social psychology we call them a moral panic, a hysterical panic happened, in which, because there was a great movement from feminism to finally acknowledge the extent of rape of women and the sexual and physical abuse of children, no one wanted to think that this issue could go off the tracks, you know, that it could turn into a kind of hysterical moral panic. Mm-hmm. But that's what began to happen. So the idea emerged throughout the 90s. Women began going into therapy, and at the prodding of their therapists, and because of under hypnosis and in some cases drugs, they would go into therapy and come out allegedly remembering that their fathers had molested them every day for 16 years, only they had repressed the memory. This is physiologically impossible. This kind of stories that were coming out were preposterous stories, yet no one wanted to blow the whistle on a kind of therapy that seemed to be validating the experiences of women. No one wanted to be critical. No one wanted to be skeptical. It marked you as being anti-feminist, and how could you be anti-child, and so forth. So in the psychotherapy world, many psychotherapists just kind of uncritically jumped on the recovered memory bandwagon and didn't stop to ask any critical questions about it. The movement itself eventually subsided as a result of malpractice lawsuits, and in some of the more egregious examples of malpractice that were being perpetrated by psychiatrists, who were creating multiple personality disorders and, you know, all kinds of terrible consequences for their patients. And that has pretty much subsided. But, now here's the but. Suppose you are a psychotherapist. You've done what you think is the right thing to do for your clients in therapy. You're a feminist. You want to believe what women tell you. You want to do the right thing for women. So you buy into this recovered memory movement. You began looking for evidence in your clients that they have all been abused or raped or traumatized as children. When they say they have not, you tell them you can't not have been. This, you know, your symptoms, you have an eating disorder, that's a symptom of having been abused. I'm going to help you remember the abuse. All of these were manipulative ways of generating false memories in clients. A terrible, terrible black blot on the profession of psychotherapy. And, you know, in our book, we found one woman, one psychotherapist who was able to go back up the pyramid, to face what she had done, to admit how wrong she was, to realize that it had indeed been created by her, to admit the harm that she had done to her patients. But for the most part, just imagine, you know, there you are. See, this is what I was saying at the beginning. You're a good, competent psychotherapist, right? And now you're telling me that I, a good, competent psychotherapist, is the one who created and rewarded and enhanced these preposterous memories in my clients? I wouldn't do that. Of course I didn't do that. So very few therapists to this day have stood up and said, we were wrong, and here's why we were wrong. And let's examine the science that tells us why we were wrong so that we will not be so susceptible to future fads. Very, very difficult to do that.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking with guest host Rochelle Saunders, standing in this week for Desiree Schell. And I'm talking with Dr. Carol Tavris, the author of Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me, and we'll be right back after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, Skeptical Inquirer Managing Editor Benjamin Radford returns to the show to discuss his newest book, Tracking the Chupacabra, The Vampire Beast in Fact, Fiction, and Folklore. He'll explain his investigation of the legendary monster and his startling conclusion about the real story behind its origins. And on the podcast, filmmaker Kennedy Goodkey joins us to celebrate the DVD release of The Beast of Bottomless Lake about the Canadian lake monster Ogopogo. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking on your local radio station or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Rochelle Saunders, standing in today for Desiree Schell, who will be back next week. I'm talking with Dr. Carol Tavris, American social psychologist and author of several fascinating books, including The Mismeasure of Women and Anger, The Misunderstood Emotion. Today we're talking about her book, Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me, which explores how cognitive dissonance affects our memory, our beliefs, and our interactions with others. So it seems like our brains really use every trick it can to keep us from admitting we're wrong. How can we use cognitive dissonance theory to be more aware and more open to our own mistakes?
A terrific question and a very important one. And thank you, by the way, for clarifying about admitting mistakes. I'd like to emphasize this. It's not news that people will lie to other people to avoid punishment and to avoid losing a job or losing a relationship. We all know when we've made a really bad mistake or we've done something illegal, unethical, or fattening that we shouldn't have, and we will come up with plenty of excuses to justify that. What cognitive dissonance is about is the mechanism that allows us to lie to ourselves so that we don't even realize in the first place that we are wrong or that we have made a mistake, as in the case of the therapist in recovered memory therapy. So that is why, see, you know, we're talking about something that allows us to lie to ourselves, that pulls the wool over our own eyes. What do we have to do to remove that wool? One of the things that I really enjoy about understanding cognitive dissonance, and working with Elliot Aronson on this was terrific because he's the king of cognitive dissonance theory, you know. I would, you know, often talk to him about what does this mean, and he's very, very good at it. And here's the point. Just as drivers of a car need know that when you back out, there's a blind spot behind you that you can't see, and anybody who's going to drive a car has to learn how to drive and accommodate that blind spot in our vision.
Right.
And it's the same with dissonance. It's exactly the same. When you know how dissonance works, you know when you will be feeling it, you can recognize the symptoms of it, and you can take steps to counteract it. So, for example, one thing we all can learn is that when we make a decision after we, I said, we'd be, whenever there's a decision that you have to make, you're going to want to get information, as I said, on both sides, do this, do that, and so forth. But that after we make a decision, we will be feeling post-decision dissonance. And that's useful. That's what keeps us from buyer's remorse. It's what lets us sleep at night and so forth. But when the decision is really a major one, an important one, and truly significant in your life or in your relationships, then sometimes a few bad nights sleep is not such a bad thing. If it allows us to reconsider evidence that we should be reconsidering. The other piece of this is we tell what to me is a wonderful story in our book of Shimon Peres, who was Prime Minister of Israel and whose great good friend Ronald Reagan accepted an invitation to go to the Bitburg Cemetery in Germany to lay a wreath there for the soldiers in the war, except that the Nazi SS were buried there as well. And people around the world were outraged by this, just outraged that Reagan would go to this cemetery for a service. And so someone asked Peres what he thought about his friend Ronald Reagan going to Bitburg. And Peres said, "When a friend makes a mistake, the friend remains a friend, and the mistake remains a mistake." Now, I don't think Peres studied dissonance theory, but that is, in a nutshell, the best way to understand how dissonance works and to prevent us from doing it in a mindless way. Most of the time, if one of our friends makes a mistake, what are we going to do? We're going to either end the friendship in a huff, because we really think the mistake is just too serious to maintain the friendship, or we'll minimize the mistake. It really wasn't such a bad thing, and, you know, yes, it's okay to whatever it was. You know, we'll minimize the mistake or end the friendship. What he is saying is, no, we can do both. We can do both. We must do both. You honor the friendship, and you don't trivialize the mistake. In the same way, for us as human beings, we can learn to say of ourselves, when I, a good, decent, kind person, make a mistake, when I, a kind person, do something that harms another person, I remain a good person, and the bad thing I did remains a bad thing, or a foolish thing, or a mistake. It doesn't have to mean what it so often does in our culture. If I do something foolish or incompetent, it means I am incompetent, foolish, and stupid. It only means the thing was. And so when we can separate the thing we did from the person we are better able to reduce dissonance in a useful way. We want our district attorneys to be able to say, when I, a good DA who cares about putting the bad guys away, make a mistake and put an innocent guy away, I want to get that innocent guy out of there so that I can get the real bad guy. And when a psychotherapist has taken up a fad that has turned out to be wrong and scientifically unvalidated, you want that therapist to be able to say, oh, my God, what did I do, and how can I help the clients I was seeing, and how can I learn from this so that I don't do it again? That's the bottom line. If we don't acknowledge when we have done wrong and have done a mistake, we can't ever learn from what we did. We can't ever improve it. We can't ever fix it. And that's the reason, really, we wrote this book.
Awesome. So we have a question from Citizen Gold.
Do people ever accept the evidence but continue with their behavior anyway?
Yes, that's called marriage. No, I'm being silly. do they accept the evidence? Well, it's hard to answer that in a very general way. Yeah, some people could say, okay, I accept the evidence that smoking is harmful. There's no way you can't. I mean, we know that smoking is harmful, but I'm going to smoke anyway because I want to smoke. But they aren't accepting the evidence in a real way. What they're doing is minimizing the evidence by saying, yeah, I understand that there's evidence that smoking is harmful, but on the other hand, look at all the other benefits it has, and it's really not so important, and it really won't affect me, and I have good genes. See? So you're accepting the evidence, but it's not affecting your behavior. But you are reducing dissonance, so it's not the same as really believing or accepting the evidence in a way that would make you change. Now, of course, people accept evidence all the time. I mean, I'm painting a darker vision here than need always be the case. Of course, many people will accept evidence that they were wrong or that they held a wrong belief or that they were misguided about some supplements or about some food theory or whatever it might be, but not, you see, if you have invested a lot of time and money and intellectual capital in that particular view. Scientists are as human as everyone else in this respect. If you spent your life studying whatever the subject is, and it turns out to be wrong, it's not so easy to let it go. I remember many, many years ago when I was working at Psychology Today magazine, when it was first starting, we interviewed D.O. Hebb, the great brain scientist, and Hebb had a terrific theory of how the brain worked. And he described in his interview how the brain works and these incredible things, and Hebb was way ahead of his time on this. And when he finished his description, he said, "Of course, it's wrong." We all said, "What? What do you mean, of course it's wrong?" He said, "It's wrong. Of course it's wrong, but it's as good as we have right now. With the data we have right now, this is the most economical and efficient way of coming up with a theory of how the brain works. And as we get more information, we will have to change."
It's as right as we can possibly be.
Yeah, we're as fine as we can possibly be now, but we'll have to let it go when new evidence comes along. And see, that's the goal, isn't it? That's what we would most like to see when we talk about the importance of scientific thinking. That we have beliefs. We all have beliefs. We have to have beliefs. We have to live by the beliefs that we care most about and that guide our lives. But the goal is to hold them lightly enough so that we can let them go if they're wrong, if we learn that, you know, you really should wash your hands because that, in the hospitals, that's the way infections are transmitted. A doctor doesn't feel that you're being insulting by saying, "By the way, did you wash your hands?" You want to be able to accept new information, new ways of doing things, improvements, an understanding of what social program went wrong, where did it go off the rails, so that we can make it better, So the answer to your questioner is, yes, of course, people can accept new information, and they do. But it's harder to do it, to really hear that information, if it's information about something you have spent a lot of time and money and effort invested in another view.
Right. I think we have time for one more question, and we have a question from Bytor.
Does cognitive dissonance tie into the research that shows with a few choices we're happy, but with a lot of choices we're more likely to worry and be depressed about the option we chose?
An excellent question, and a very important point, that the more choices we have, the less we like them. Where dissonance comes in is not before the choice, but after the choice. That's where dissonance is most relevant. So this is quite kind of a different thing. If you're given, 27 choices of jam, you may just say, "Oh, you know what, the hell with it, I'm going to go back and have my original jam." But what dissonance says is, after you make a jam choice, whether it's one of three or one of 27, that's the jam. You're going to just know in your heart is the best of all jams.
Awesome. Well, I have so many more questions, but unfortunately we're all out of time today. Thank you so much for being here, Carol.
It's my pleasure, Rochelle.
You can find out more about Dr. Carol Tavris and her book at mistakeswereMadeButNotByMe.com or at the link on our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. From there, click the links to Facebook, Twitter, or to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review. Thanks for listening. It's been a pleasure guest hosting today, and Desiree Schell will be back next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Schell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells, cause we're skeptically speaking. Online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Schell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.